I became a dramatic monologuist. I became a pinup model under the name of Gigi Frost. I worked my way through Berkeley as a stripper. It seems to me that my life has been so diverse. I've been such various personages, and I wanted to see how they fit together.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Transsexuals gain marriage rights in Europe. There's a win for queer students and a loss for the Boy Scouts in U.S. courts. And academic icon Lillian Faderman traces her uncommon path to the promised land. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 10th, 2004. Transsexuals won marriage rights throughout the European Union with a ruling this week by the EU's highest court, the European Court of Justice in Brussels. The European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg had previously upheld transsexuals' right to marry a partner of the gender opposite their own self-identified one. The case before the Court of Justice was that of a British female nurse, known as KB, whose trans man partner, known as R, cannot receive spousal survivor benefits in event of her death because they cannot marry. KB has been contributing to her pension fund throughout her 20 years of work with Britain's National Health Service. The Court of Justice found this situation an inequality of treatment in breach of human rights, such that Britain's marriage law is incompatible with European law. The Court of Justice sent the case itself back to Britain's legal system for further action. Almost all the current European Union countries do legally recognize sex changes and allow marriages accordingly, but a bill to that effect is only now before the British Parliament. The Court of Justice ruling may have its greatest impact on the 10 nations that will become the EU's newest members in May.
Scotland's smallest county, Clackmannanshire, will become its first to officially register gay and lesbian partnerships. The commitment ceremonies were approved by the so-called Wee Counties Council this week, along with civil ceremonies for births, renewals of marriage vows, and attainment of citizenship, effective immediately. Registry carries no legal status, but the British Parliament is currently considering domestic partnerships, which Scotland is expected to adopt as soon as they're enacted. Press reports emphasized criticism from religious leaders of several denominations. But a council spokesperson defended the move, saying that, "As a council, we're particularly keen to ensure we are able to offer the widest possible choice to our service users."
The Israeli parliament, the Knesset, last week gave preliminary approval to explicitly extending government compensation for a spouse's accidental death to domestic partners, regardless of gender. Despite vocal opposition from conservatives, the bill passed its first reading by a 3-2 margin. Marriages in Israel can be performed only by rabbis for couples who qualify under Orthodox Jewish law, and legal recognition of unmarried heterosexual couples is as politically divisive as for same-gender couples. But even some of Israel's Orthodox rabbis may be ready to reconsider their stance on gays and lesbians. As a workshop on homosexuality held at an international rabbinical convention in Jerusalem last week is being hailed as a first. The workshop itself was closeted under the title Bringing Hearts Closer in a Time of Modern Questions.
The U.S. state of New Jersey is on its way to legal recognition of same-gender partnerships, with state Senate approval of more than 70% this week. The state House had already passed the bill last month, so it now moves to Governor James McGreevy, who's already said he'll sign it into law. Primarily, the bill extends spousal benefits to the registered domestic partners of New Jersey civil servants, including unmarried heterosexual partners over age 62. But registry will also grant other New Jersey couples rights to hospital visitation and medical decision-making, and it requires health insurance carriers to offer them spousal coverage. It carries no parental or property rights, but allows partners to claim each other as dependents in state income tax filings and to qualify for state spousal inheritance tax exemptions. The state Senate debate was surprisingly tame, lasting only 15 minutes as no senator spoke against the measure on the floor. All the opposition votes were cast by Republicans, with almost as many senators abstaining. Meanwhile, a lawsuit for full equal marriage rights is currently pending before New Jersey Appeals Court.
Elsewhere in the U.S. this week, legal cases on civil rights concluded. In California, the Morgan Hill Unified School District agreed to pay a total of more than $1 million to settle a lawsuit brought by six gays and lesbians who'd experienced harassment and discrimination as middle school and high school students in the 1990s. Their five-year-old lawsuit claimed that administrators and teachers had failed to intervene when they were abused by other students. The school district, which did not admit any wrongdoing, also agreed to strengthen its policies and to train all of its staff and its middle school students towards elimination of anti-gay harassment and discrimination. The students were represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and a private San Francisco law firm. The school district was spurred to settle by a ruling last year by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that public school administrators' failure to effectively counter homophobic harassment constitutes a violation of the right to equal protection guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution.
Another California legal settlement of about $1 million was reached this week as the city of San Diego cut its ties with the Boy Scouts of America because of the Scouts' policy of discrimination against gays and atheists. The American Civil Liberties Union had filed the lawsuit more than 3 years ago on behalf of two boys who feel they cannot join the Scouts, one because his parents are a lesbian couple and the other because his parents are agnostic. The Scouts had enjoyed long-term leases in two San Diego parks for only a token fee. A federal court ruled in July that that was a violation of separation of church and state, and the city will now end its preferential treatment of the Scouts. The city's payment is to defray the plaintiff's court costs and attorney's fees. But while the San Diego City Council has agreed to go along with the ACLU, the Scouts are determined to hang on to the land and have sought help from the U.S. Department of Justice. They also plan to appeal the federal court's ruling as soon as the case is officially completed.
That appeal would be heard by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and a ruling it issued bodes ill for the Scouts. This week, that panel rejected a claim of religious discrimination by a former employee at an Idaho office of electronics giant Hewlett-Packard. In 2000, the company began an internal campaign to implement its diversity policy, displaying assorted posters with the slogan, "Diversity is our strength." One of those, featuring gay employees, was posted near the desk of Richard Peterson, who responded by posting in his workspace biblical quotations against homosexuality that could be read by passers-by. His supervisor believed this to violate company policy against harassment and took the quotes down, but Peterson said he'd remove them only if the company removed its gay tolerance posters. Ultimately, he was fired for insubordination, but filed his lawsuit in the belief he'd been unfairly singled out. A three-judge panel of the appeals court upheld a federal trial judge's finding that Hewlett-Packard had the right to enforce its anti-discrimination policy, even at the expense of Peterson's freedom of expression, and that his message differed from others in the workplace because it attempted to generate a hostile and intolerant work environment. Peterson plans to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
There were mixed messages on civil rights this week for gays and lesbians in Singapore. Last year, the prime minister created a stir by revealing they'd be allowed to serve in government jobs despite the nation's sodomy laws. Currently, the government is reviewing the penal code towards a major overhaul, and this week its minister for law told the parliament that decriminalization of oral sex is under consideration. However, it's widely believed that it's only oral sex between a male and a female that would become legal. On the other hand, the deputy prime minister indicated in a speech this week that the government's plans to increase political and social freedom are likely to include an end to the current ban on official registration of gay and lesbian organizations. DPM Lee Hsien-Loong largely blamed the nation's slow movement on gay and lesbian issues on Muslim opposition. Despite the ban on official registry, though, Singapore's first counseling service for gays and lesbians, the Pelangi Pride Center, opened last month.
And finally, one current internet poll is now showing strong support for equal marriage rights for U.S. gays and lesbians. Some 470,000 respondents affirmed, "I favor legalization of homosexual marriage," with another more than 62,000 choosing, "I favor a civil union with the full benefits of marriage, except for the name," for total support of more than 67%. Thanks to gay and lesbian email lists, this is rather more support for legal recognition of same-gender couples than most professional surveys are currently finding in the U.S. But what's really surprising is the web host of this poll. It's the virulently anti-gay American Family Association. The online poll is part of the AFA's so-called Help Save Marriage campaign, and the group is on record with its promise to pass the results on to Congress members.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending January 10th, 2004. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
I've only got a couple of minutes to remind you that 2003 was one heck of a queer year, and that we've got the sounds to prove it. Steve Pride recalls the year's most memorable queer-themed offerings on the big and small screen.
Actually contains no sinking ocean liners, no high-speed car chases.
My film is about a few years that I spent pretending to be somebody else before I went to prison.
We're friends of 43 years, and we're lovers of 27 years.
It centers around a gay male couple who are enforcers for the mafia.
You wouldn't even think, you know, 20 years ago, that you ever would have this many gay and lesbian films.
Our film is about Bayard Rustin, this gay African-American civil rights hero.
This is a queer buddy movie.
It's a social, gender, sexuality, drama comedy.
Why are you hiding in the potting shed?
I wasn't hiding.
It's all about identity. It's all about visibility.
The producers of Audiophile choose their favorite out music of the year.
I want to double my wardrobe. Leave the seat up late at night.
Say a prayer for me, Sarah.
I like a man who is crazy about me.
Ginger's my favorite thing.
I'll cross into your heart if you cross into mine.
I listen to the wind of my soul.
He's the best darn thing to come down the pike in a good long while. I like Mike.
And there's a keepsake collection of the biggest queer news stories of 2003.
It says intended bridegroom and intended bride. How are intended spouse and intended spouse?
The Supreme Court says that we matter and we're valuable.
Being gay is not a crime.
To press forward with this consecration will be to turn our backs on Almighty God.
It's not about me. It's about so many other people at the margins.
Finally, all families in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will have the opportunity to be equal families under the law.
One or more of these 2003 queer audio history and culture CDs can be yours. For all the details, log on to thiswayout.org. The groundbreaking works of academic powerhouse Lillian Faderman have torn the closet doors off the lives of lesbians from as early as the 17th century. In her latest book, Faderman turns a critical eye to her own story. This Way Out correspondent Chris Allen produced this fascinating profile.
If there's a common path one takes to becoming an esteemed academic icon, Lillian Faderman was certainly not on it. Her newest book, Naked in the Promised Land, is a memoir that covers her childhood through her first 39 years. It's the story of her unrelenting journey through her remarkable and unorthodox life, written with such honesty and candor that it leaves the author vulnerable and at times, yes, even naked. While Faderman shares her life story with her readers in the book, she begins here by discussing the insights gained in the writing of her memoir.
It seems to me that my life has been so diverse. I've been such various personages, and I wanted to see how they fit together. I divide the book into these three sections, Lily and Lil and Lillian, and I think I chose that division because it seemed to me that those were three very distinct periods of my life, and one had nothing to do with another. And to write this book and to see the connections, it was so exciting.
The story begins with her earliest memories from childhood.
I began as Lily, a child of an unmarried immigrant woman who worked in the garment industry in sweatshops in both New York, where I was born, and Los Angeles, where we came when I was 7.5 years old. My mother went to work every day to support us as hard as it was, but she would come home and she would moan so often, "Rescue me from the shop." I was about 5 or 6 years old. And I thought she really meant it. I said, "How, Mommy? What should I do?" And she said, "Become a movie star." Of course, those were the days of Shirley Temple, and I took that absolutely seriously. That then became my mission. I was going to become a movie star and rescue my mother from the shop. We came to California when I was 7 and a half, and my eye was out for the main chance at 7 and a half. How was I going to make it in Hollywood? Finally, when I was about almost 12, a place that I call in the book Theater Arts Studio opened in East Los Angeles, and my mother gave me money to take acting lessons. I think it was about $1.50 per lesson in those days. I became a dramatic monologuist, and the director of Theater Arts Studio said that I needed a stage name, and my stage name became Lillian Foster. So Lillian Foster was this 12 to 15-year-old who would go around with this little troupe of kid actors to places like hospitals and store openings.
Although her mind was set on acting, Lily's heart gets in the way when she meets Irene Sandman.
She was the director, beautiful woman, and she became a role model for me, but also my first terrific crush. In fact, when I was about 13, the crush took on such huge proportions that I simply didn't know what to do with it. So I went to the library to look up what this means. How could I, a 13-year-old girl, be so in love with this beautiful older woman? I found all of these books, and they talked about adolescent crushes, and they assured me that it was very normal. So that sort of made me feel better. But then I found another book, and I still remember the color of the book cover. It was by Dr. George W. Korner. It was called Attaining Womanhood, A Doctor Talks to Girls About Sex. And there was a section in there that talked specifically about some women who love only other women and who desire to have sex with other women. And Dr. Korner said that such people should not be penalized or punished in any way because they couldn't help it. It was simply a sickness, which made me feel pretty sick, of course. Dr. Korner also said girls should be aware of older women who are excessively friendly and want to be with them too much. And I remember thinking, oh, if only Irene were such a woman. She wasn't.
In this excerpt from her book, Faderman reveals to Irene the true nature of her feelings.
She sat down behind her desk on our gray metal chair. So what is it? I couldn't face those eyes. I studied my bald fists. When I looked up after an eternity, her hand was extended across the desk, palm up. I dared. I grasped. At last, her silk skin, her warm clasp. I was touching Irene Sandman. I would never let go. You can tell me, she said softly. I have a terrible crush on you, tumbled out of my mouth when I opened it, the ventriloquist dummy, and I couldn't stop. I'm afraid this is how homosexuals begin. I felt her fingers twitch in surprise, but I held firm, a drowning clutch. I think I'd better leave, bubbled out now. Where had that come from? Because I don't want to be one of them. I hadn't rehearsed any of those lines that escaped from me, and I know that's what will happen if I stay here, because I can't help myself. Now, why was I saying that? There was Carlos. If he'd be different, I'd still be his girlfriend. I forced up the memory of his lips on my neck. Then I inhaled her perfume, and the scent filled my brain and washed everything else out. I just looked down at our clasped hands, my dark olive fingers against her pink and white palm. The miracle of it. And I clutched harder. I could hear the clock tick-ticking on the wall right above my head. When I finally looked up, I saw tears in her beautiful eyes. I hadn't seen anything like that since she'd said, wow, the first time she saw me do Rachel Hoffman. She sniffed. Or did she have a cold? No, the wonder of it. I'd moved her. It didn't matter about being an actress anymore. There were tears in her eyes for me. I would stay just to be near her. I know this is hard for you, she murmured, and her fingers moved under my grip. These things can be terrible. Now she wriggled her hand free of mine and dabbed at her nose with a Kleenex. You're probably right, she said. It would be better for you to go. What was she talking about? No, it's a mistake, I wanted to cry out. I would fall to my knees and kiss the hem of her dress. I would grab her hand back. I would be her little dog. Please let me stay, I would beg. But I couldn't stay. I needed to become somebody else. And maybe it was true that what I'd felt for her was the way homosexuals begin, and I didn't want to be one. I didn't know what was true anymore.
At this point, Faderman continues to pursue her acting career in a new studio, but things are not going as she'd hoped.
I met a young man who told me that he was studying to be an agent, and I asked him what I had to do to break into Hollywood, and he said, well, the first thing you have to do is get publicity pictures. And I said, well, there's no way I could do that. I certainly couldn't afford publicity pictures. And he said, well, I know of a photographer who will do publicity pictures for you if you do pinup modeling for him. And so I became a pinup model. The job essentially entailed wearing things like harem pants and fans and beach balls and the silly pinup poses of the 1950s. I became a pinup model under the name of Gigi Frost, but was known to all of my friends as Lil, a pretty tough adolescent. It was also about the time that I started going to the gay girls' bars, as lesbian bars were called at that time in Los Angeles. I came to a dead end. It was clear that I wasn't going to make it as a Hollywood actress, as my mother had wanted me to. The person that I had a relationship with that I met at the Open Door on 8th and Vermont in 1956 was a pretty tough character and was really sliding down the tubes quickly, and I felt I was sliding with her. And so I felt that I was lost. I was 16, and I was thinking I was just going to drop out of school. The year before, I'd gotten all D's and F's at Fairfax High School.
Faderman decided to reach out for help and found a social worker willing to counsel her for free.
Maury really saved my life. For the first time in my life, somebody told me about the value of education. Somebody told me that in America, one was incredibly free to do the dumbest things with your life, to destroy yourself if you wanted to go down that path, or to do good things with your life. And I believed him, and he was right, as it turned out. He convinced me of the importance of education, and so I didn't drop out of school after that summer as I was going to. I transferred to Hollywood High School and really took it seriously, and I got into college.
Throughout the many chapters of her life the author shares with us, none is more surprising than finding pictures of her as a scantily clad burlesque dancer, followed 15 pages later by a sedate and dignified graduate photo from UC Berkeley.
I worked my way through Berkeley as a stripper, and I did that because I had worked in the library for a while at $1.25 an hour, which was minimum wage, and worked 20 hours a week, and I didn't have the time to study. And I was living with a woman, the first woman that I was seriously in love with, long-term for a 19 to 22-year-old. It lasted for 3 years. And she was sick and couldn't work. And again, it seemed like a very logical thing to do, to become a burlesque dancer at a theater where I would only have to go on stage 3 times during each show for a maximum of 20 minutes, perhaps. And the rest of the time I could sit in the dressing room and read George Eliot and Theodore Dreiser and Emily Dickinson, and that's what I did. But it meant, of course, that I couldn't tell anyone at UC Berkeley what I did for a living. And I couldn't tell anyone at the President Follies that I was a college student, because, of course, there was the fear that it would get back to the administration at UC Berkeley. But that isn't the only kind of secrecy that one had during those years from 1959 to 1962. I couldn't tell anyone on campus that I was a lesbian, because I would have been kicked out of the university if I had done that as well. I really thought during those years that I was the only gay person on campus. No sign of other lesbians, no sign even of other gay men. Finally, shortly before I graduated in 1962, I saw this very butch, very tall, handsome woman, and I thought, she's got to be one. And somehow I maneuvered it so that I met her, and we became friends for a while. And she told me that she, too, believed all those years that she was the only lesbian on campus. Absolutely no sign of any kind of gay life.
Faderman's life was clearly a series of remarkable, unorthodox, and seemingly unrelated events at a very young age. However, what is most significant to her now is the amazing insight she's gained about life from putting these experiences together in her memoir.
Writing the book taught me that there's really a core to personality, and I'm sure everyone has that experience. We can do all sorts of diverse things in our life, but somehow that little kid, whoever that was, it doesn't change. The core of personality when we were 7 years old is not that different from who we are when we're 60 or 70. When I came across the country, I was on a train for 4 days. This was in 1948. I was 7 and a half years old. And through most of that time, except late at night when I would collapse in exhaustion, I would tap dance up and down the aisle and sing California, Here I Come. But I was hoping that there would be a director who would discover me. And it was just this drive and determination in this 7-year-old kid that I think was probably the same in Mink Frost, this person who went to UC Berkeley by day but realized that she had to make a living for herself and the woman she was in love with, and who in 1962 decided to get a PhD. It was hard enough for middle and upper-class women to think in those terms in 1962, but for a working-class woman, it was very difficult, but it's consistent with personality. That person who enrolled in UCLA graduate school is the same person who shuffled up and down the aisles singing California, Here I Come.
Faderman in turn hopes to motivate similar discoveries in her readers.
What I hope this book will do is I hope it will cause the reader to find what's consistent in their personalities as well, how they became the person they became. I hope it'll be thought-provoking along those lines.
Lillian Faderman's inspiring and candid memoir is entitled Naked in the Promised Land, a Memoir, and is published by Houghton Mifflin Company. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Allen.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill-Fensbury, Rex Walkner, and Chris Allen contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUMD Duluth, Minnesota, CJSR Edmonton, Alberta, WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We sure hope you'll stay tuned.